You're listening to WSDL 90.7 FM. It's time now for the Wallops and Assateague Islands Report with your host, Robin Rothschild.
Hello, I'm Robin, and welcome to the Wallops and Assateague Islands Report. Today, our guest is Mr. Lou Hines. He's manager of the Chincoteague National Wildlife Refuge. Hey, Lou, how are you?
Good morning, Robin. And what a great day we've got today going on outside. Isn't it beautiful?
Gorgeous.
I know. You know, it's nice today. I hope your listeners are watching the sky, though, because I think tomorrow it's going to be a little ugly.
Oh, yeah. I just drove in from D.C., and they're expecting about 6 inches of snow there.
Yeah. I think we're going to get a lot of rain, but for us, it's going to be the winds coming off the ocean and the potential for coastal flooding. But I ask everybody just to keep their radios tuned or watch their local media for those advisories as they come about.
Well, thanks, Lou. So, Lou, how are things over at the Chincoteague National Wildlife Refuge these days?
Well, Robin, I'll tell you the truth. We're doing quite well. It's coming around to spring, and the birds are migrating through. The big thing for us is we're still doing a bit of recovery from Hurricane Sandy. We're still not fully recovered from that. The public comes and enjoys their day, but we still have roofs on our buildings that need to be repaired. Our road, beach road that goes out to the beach, just has temporary repairs on it. We're not ready for this summer's visitation yet. And the National Park Service, who is our sister agency that works with us out there on the beach, they haven't made much headway on preparing for this coming summer as far as repairing the parking lots. There is parking out on the beach, but it's very limited at this time. And I'm a bit concerned that tomorrow's storm may take that parking out as well.
Well, you know, I did get a chance to get out there right after Sandy. And I tell you, it was quite shocking to see the damage that was done out at the refuge, especially on the roads and the beach and that big, what do you call that, that waterway that cuts through?
We call that a breach in the beach. And it was named after the very first bird. When it first opened up during Hurricane Irene, it was named after an avocet. That was the very first bird we saw feeding in the waterway. So we call it Avocet Inlet. But it's not really an inlet. It's just a breach in the beach. And that's a quite natural thing to take place, Robin, along coastal barrier islands. If there's sufficient sand source coming down or sufficient sediment supply coming down the beach, it will heal itself. And that's what happens to Avocet Inlet. Mother Nature opens it up during these big storm events. As soon as the storm passes and the ocean calms down, then the sediment supply that's coming from the north coming down the beach heals that, and it quickly closes up.
And I heard you mention previously that actually is a good thing when that happens.
Well, it is for the refuge and our visitors, that's for sure. Robin, as you know, but I don't know if your listeners know, that Chincoteague National Wildlife Refuge was established in 1943 for migratory birds. All right, primarily snow geese and black ducks. But, you know, that was the thinking back in those days, and was the reason that this land was purchased. Now, over the years, we put in what we call impoundments. We have about 2,600 acres of impoundments that we manage for waterfowl, shorebirds, long-legged wading birds, any of the birds that use water as part of their life cycle. And so and that's all birds use some water for their life cycle, but I mean the ones that get out there and actually wade around in the mud. But getting back to it, when we get these huge storm events and we get these tidal surges that come in, what was happening is the tidal surge was going way back in the refuge and flooding all of these impoundments with salt water, right. And there was no way for that water to get out. This is why Avocet breach in the beach is actually a very good thing for us, because now when that happens, and it's only started happening since Hurricane Irene, that when that opens up, it allows everything to drain out very quickly. And we get that salt water off, and then any fresh water rain that we get washes the impoundments out, flushes them out, and we can get back to a healthy freshwater wetlands more quickly than we were able to in the past. If you remember the coastal storm we had in 2009, it was we labeled Ida nor'easter.
I remember it well.
Yeah, when that one happened, the breach did not form, and all the impoundments and the refuge back roads that people use to get around to see wildlife remained flooded for a full week. It took a week to get the water off. Here, right after a storm, when we have a breach that forms like that, as soon as the tide goes down, the water flushes out. It takes us a couple of days to stabilize, but then it's all over with. It's gone. So it is a very good thing for us.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is how, you know, Mother Nature just took one problem off your desk.
Yeah, I call them balloons. I have all these balloons I try to carry, you know, balls I try to keep in the air. Mother Nature definitely helped me out with that one.
So you guys are still recovering from Sandy. When I did go out there, it was amazing. First of all, the beach was bigger,
yeah,
a lot bigger.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, and that's something that people fail to realize, that when a barrier island is functioning naturally, these strong storms will carry sand in the waves up and across the current beach and deposit it on the western side of the island. And when that happens, you build island to the west. So many times you'll hear scientists and beach geomorphologists, they'll talk about our barrier islands moving from the east to the west. And you can see that after a storm. You can look at aerial photographs or whatever immediately after a storm. We have a photographer. His name is Patrick Hendrickson. He gets up and he takes a lot of aerial photos. And he gets up after a storm, and you can actually see the overwash fans. These are these big deposits where the water ran across and deposited sand on the western side. And that's a healthy thing. It creates habitat to the west and allows the island to move naturally. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, without barrier islands, our coastal areas, our upland coastal areas, would be taking the brunt of the Atlantic Ocean. So allowing these barrier islands to move naturally is a good thing.
Lou, we were just speaking earlier about there is a lot of confusion out there, and as I even mentioned, a lot locally, that you are with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and that is the agency that owns the Chincoteague National Wildlife Refuge. But the beach, however, is managed by the National Park Service.
Perfect, Robin, and thank you for asking that question, because it is a very confusing arrangement that we seem to have with the National Park Service. It works very well at the agency's level, but for the American public, it is confusing. So let me clarify that. We have a little bit of time here, so let me clarify. In 1943, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service purchased the southern end of Assateague Island. Now, when I say the southern end, it was at from the Virginia-Maryland border all the way down to that spit of land known as Tom's Cove Hook. And that was about a little over 8,000 acres. And it was purchased with duck stamp money. This is the money that duck hunters pay when they're going to go out duck hunting. They buy a duck stamp, and all that purchase, that 8,000 acres, was purchased by duck hunters and by buying that stamp.
Mm.
Now, so the land was set aside for migratory birds. In 1962, many of your listeners will remember the Ash Wednesday storm. Now, the Ash Wednesday storm was historically significant, both in the power of the storm and in the changes in the future development that took place in the area. Congress, the United States Congress, realized that it was not wise to develop barrier beach islands. And Assateague, they had already looked at Assateague at possibly being a national seashore, but that had been put on a back shelf because of development pressures. When we had the Ash Wednesday storm, and it wiped out whatever roads and houses had been built. There was much more, what I'll say, logical thinking.
Yes.
And they said, you know, it doesn't make sense for us to develop these barrier islands. So they passed a bill, and that bill got signed by Lyndon Johnson, President Johnson, in 1965, and that established the Assateague Island National Seashore. And so it took in from Ocean City, and Congress, in its infinite wisdom, put an overlay over top of the refuge to further protect the refuge. So Assateague Island now in its entirety is both a national seashore and, on the southern end, a national wildlife refuge. All right. So and we have one other entity that actually exists out there, and that's the state of Maryland has the Assateague Island State Park. And there is a small state park for the state of Maryland that operates out there on the north end of Assateague Island. So that's how we got where we are today. Now, Robin, I got to make this very clear for your listeners. On the southern end, we own the land. I say we. The Department of the Interior owns the land, but the purpose for the refuge is migratory birds. However, since the National Park Service is also a umbrella over top of the refuge, they manage a recreational beach. National wildlife refuges, there are very few national wildlife refuges that have a recreational beach. Chincoteague National Wildlife Refuge is one, but it's not a purpose of the refuge. Our purpose is migratory birds and endangered species. So the National Park Service, we designate an area for the National Park Service to administer a recreational beach, and they do a great job. And
yes,
that's
they
what
do.
Everybody knows about that recreational beach, and it is a major economic driver for the region. We just had an economic study done, and it's worth to the region's economy about $113 million.
Wow.
And that's just on the south end on that beach. It's big bucks. So, you know, we're very proud of that, and it takes the two agencies to work together to manage it. But for the Fish and Wildlife Service, it's just designating an area. And that's what we've done, and that's where the beach is right now. And the Park Service manages it.
You know, Lou, I mean, I just learned something. So thank you for taking the time to really explain that in depth.
Well, it's important because I want your listeners to know that they should be happy, proud of the fact that there are two government agencies, sister agencies, the National Park Service and the Fish and Wildlife Service, working together to preserve habitat, but then also provide quality outdoor recreation.
Exactly. And I tell you, from going to that beach all the time, it is just, it's gorgeous. It's just one of my favorite beaches in the world, quite honestly.
And as you might expect, mine too.
You know, we got to touch on the ponies.
Okay.
Because, you know, I get this a lot from being in Ocean City, growing up there during the summer, and now living on Chincoteague. You know, well, in Maryland, the ponies run wild, and then on Assateague in Virginia, they're running wild, but they're not running on the street,
right?
Typically.
Well, they are right now.
They are right, yeah. That's what I said, typically.
Typically, yeah. You got it.
I've seen a few. You know, and I think that it's also interesting that, you know, the people don't realize that the Virginia Chincoteague ponies are owned by the Chincoteague Volunteer Fire Company.
That is correct. And that's an important part. That's an important statement you just made there, Robin. And we got to go back. On the north end, the horses there are managed, the horse herd and health is managed by the National Park Service. That's actually one of the things that they look at the ponies as a cultural resource. You know, they've been on the island for hundreds and hundreds of years. When the Fish and Wildlife Service purchased the land in 1943, we literally had what's the word I want to use here? We had all different types of uses taken out there, and grazing was one of them. We had sheep. We had goats. We had cattle. We had horses. And as you might expect, those hungry critters could do a lot of damage to wildlife habitat because they'll eat everything. So over the years, we managed to, pretty quickly in the 1940s, we got rid of the sheep and the goats and all that kind of stuff. But we still had cattle grazing and we still had horse grazing on the refuge. We gave permits, grazing permits for the cattle grazing and for the horse grazing in the late 40s and the early 50s. By about 53, we narrowed the permits down to one. We got rid of the cattle off of Assateague Island, and we had only the Chincoteague Volunteer Fire Department had a grazing permit, to graze 150 adult Chincoteague ponies. Now, notice I said adults.
Yes.
I didn't say foals, just the adults. So, yes, the Chincoteague Volunteer Fire Department manages the ponies on the island, and every year they round those up, and to keep those numbers in check, they auction off the foals of the year at their big July festival that they have, their
pony swim
and corral and roundup.
Pony
and,
penny.
And it's an amazing time. I hope your listeners come to it. It really is an amazing time on the island when you think of this sleepy little community of about 3,500 yep. people out there on the island. And that population grows during July to 25,000 people or so for the pony roundup. That's it's amazing thing to see that tiny little tourist community, fishing village community gets quite active at that time of the year. But anyway, getting back to the pony. So the ponies are not a purpose of the refuge. But the big thing is the volunteer fire department does a great job in managing those ponies. And we work very well together. Again, it's one of those partnerships that we've entered into, and we like it. I mean, I feel very comfortable with Harry Thornton and the pony committee and the whole fire department in general. They're a great bunch of men and women dedicated yep. to the community, and they do pony management quite well. I will tell you, when we were talking about right just a couple of minutes ago, Hurricane Sandy dropped a whole bunch of trees on their fences, and that's the reason the ponies are wandering around right now out on the street. So I would encourage your listeners that if they're going to visit the refuge, going to come down here, be very careful out on the roads because the ponies, there are probably about a dozen that are out of the pastures right now and are wandering around on the road. So be very careful.
And they're not used to cars like the Maryland side are.
No, that is correct.
They're not. They're definitely not. This is interesting. The Chincoteague ponies down there at the refuge are still there under that original grazing permit.
That is correct. It's been
that's
a long-standing
cool.
relationship.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, they actually were there. The first pony roundup, and Robin, don't hold me to this date, but the first pony roundup by the Chincoteague Volunteer Fire Department, I believe, was 1925. It was either 1925 or 1927. So the roundups were taking place before the refuge got there. All right. And it was a longstanding tradition. I mean, roundups, the very first roundups were actually sheep roundups.
Yeah, that's right.
All right.
Yep.
So we got to go back a long time. But anyway, that tradition carries on to this day, and it's kind of a wonderful thing to say.
That is fabulous, and it's great that you guys have a good partnership there.
Yeah, we do.
I do want to touch on a little story that I heard about a shoe that you found on the beach.
You know, this all comes back to Hurricane Sandy, doesn't it? You know, trees on fences, you know, parking lots. Yeah. It all comes back. Well, Robin, yeah, this was one of those interesting things that take place after coastal storms. I'm sure your listeners know that if you go out on Assateague Island or you go on almost any barrier beach island after a good storm, things wash up. You know, you'll find a lot, you'll find tires, you'll find wood, you'll find kids' plastic toys, and you may even find a shoe once in a while. Well, that's what I found. I was out on the beach at the urging of a volunteer, one of our refuge volunteers. He had been out on the beach, and he noticed that there was a lot of look like historic marine debris out on shipwreck debris out on the southern end of the island. So I told him I'd get out there, and sure enough, a day later I did, and I went and I found a very large debris pile on the southwestern edge of Tom's Cove Hook. Now, I got to stop for just a second and just tell your listeners, and I think they already know this, that Hurricane Sandy was a storm of two faces. When it was off the East Coast, we had the winds out of the northeast. And they were strong, and the tidal surge is what got the refuge. That was part of the damage that was done to the refuge. But when a storm went inland in New Jersey, our wind shifted and came out of the southwest. Now, the southwest winds are the winds that knocked all the trees down on the refuge, and that is something that we're still dealing with, is down trees. But in addition to that, a lot of marine shipwreck parts washed up on the southwest side of Assateague Island, Tom's Cove Hook area. And when I got out there and I looked around, in between all that debris, I saw this shoe. Now, you got to understand, I'm seeing sandals, I'm seeing flippers, and I'm seeing a whole bunch of stuff. You know, it's just marine debris. But this shoe was nestled in among the shipwreck parts. And I passed by it the first time. And there was just something in the back of my mind said, you know, go back to that shoe. There's something interesting there. So I did. I went back. I looked at it some more, picked it up. We ended up bringing it back to the refuge. We photographed it and then sent it off to some experts in that field. I sent it up to a regional historian up in Hadley, Massachusetts. They sent it out. Literally, it's amazing. When you put something on the web, it goes around the world pretty quickly. And it ended up at the desk of a gentleman who was a shoe expert over in Williamsburg, Virginia, mm-hmm. Working at Williamsburg. And he got back to us and said, Lou, we're thinking that shoe is probably at least dating back to the 1860s.
Wow.
So we took it over to, we put it in fresh water and got and leached out the salt out of it, and then took it over to Williamsburg for their curation. They did the work over there and gave us a write-up on it. And they're stating now that they think it's somewhere around the 1870 time period, but the techniques that were used to make the shoe could go all the way back into the 1850s, 1860, and then forward into 1880s. So, yeah, we found an old shoe. A really old shoe.
Was it in good condition?
It was in fairly good condition as far as the leather and just looking at it on the surface. But the gentleman, and I say gentleman, that was wearing this, he really wore it to the end. I mean, there were holes worn in the bottom. He had knocked the heel off it and continued to wear it after the heel had been knocked off. So it was a good one.
Well, I mean, anytime you find anything that old just laying on the beach, it's cool. Well, we've just got a few minutes, Lou, so I do want to ask you, going on right now at the refuge, it's been going on now for about 2 years, I believe, is the Comprehensive Conservation Plan. Uh-oh. This has been in the Washington Post. It's big news in not only the local area, but in the cities that come down to visit our area. What can you tell us about what is going on with that and the time frame of that?
Okay. Well, for your listeners to understand, a comprehensive conservation plan has been mandated by Congress. Every National Wildlife Refuge has to do one. It's a long-range 15-year planning document. We are about ready to release to the public the environmental impact statement of that comprehensive conservation plan in its draft form. Now, that hopefully will be out at the end of March, if not certainly in April, it will come out, and the American public will have an opportunity to look at that plan and give us feedback. We will have a draft preferred alternative for people to look at. So, Robin, what I would like you to do is invite me back when we actually release it, and we will do a full explanation of those alternatives.
That would be fantastic. Lou, is this one of the final stages? Because, you know, being on Chincoteague, I've been to several meetings that you've had, several public meetings, and these are the plans that you're looking at.
That is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. They're still in draft form, but
right,
you will see a preferred alternative, draft alternative in there. And, you know, we're hoping people are going to give us lots of public, good quality comments back to us.
All right. And I would love to have you back as soon as that's released, and we will talk about that in depth.
All right. Thanks, Robin.
Thanks, Lou, for coming, and I want to wish everyone a wonderful day.
This has been the Wallops and Assateague Islands Report on WSDL 90.7 FM. Robin Rothschild is your host. Chris Rank is your executive producer and technical director. For podcasts of this program, please visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net.